You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
1,000 years ago or more, we the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois, were given the rules and processes of democracy. The principles of this democracy are peace in mind and community, equity, which is justice for the people, and the power of the good minds, which embodies good health and reason. This democracy is all-inclusive. Democracy is direct access to leadership. Democracy is equal protection under law. True democracy does not abide privilege nor centralized control of power. Leadership is privileged only to serve, and the leader's needs come last after the people.
Those words were spoken in 1995 by Orrin Lyons, faith keeper of the Onondaga Nation and longtime environmental and anti-globalization activist. We'll be presenting a recent speech by Chief Lyons in the second hour of the program. In the first hour, people resisting water privatization in Bolivia, the fight to close a U.S. military school for assassins, and then, to lead us into Orrin Lyons, indigenous peoples' worldwide resistance to corporate globalization. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
There's not a rider from east to west. Darkness and midnight, when the pot-bellied beasts chase their unwelcome guests.
Water has become the next speculative commodity to be grabbed. Pay close attention, because much of the world's drinkable water is here, in the Northeast, in our lakes. Can you imagine being told you must pay money to a corporation if you want to pump water out of your own well? This happened to the people of Cochabamba, Bolivia, who took to the streets last year to defend their access to water. Kelly Romara spoke with Bolivian water rights activist Gabriel Erbas about the ongoing struggle against water privatization in his country.
Under heavy pressure from the IMF and the World Bank, the Bolivian government agreed last year to a contract with Bechtel Corporation, which gave the privately held San Francisco-based engineering company control over the water system of Cochabamba, Bolivia's third largest city. The contract was so broad, it gave Bechtel control of the municipal water system and water from private wells. Water rates soon skyrocketed, and the people of Cochabamba used direct action to force cancellation of the contract.
What was your occupation before you became an activist, and what is your role as an activist today?
Bueno, soy profesor universitario y consultor.
I'm a university professor, and I've also been a consultant.
Mi rol dentro l'activismo es por dos vías. Uno por la vía de la defensa del medio ambiente y otro por mi calidad de profesional.
I've been involved in two lines of activism. The first one is related to the work in defense of the environment, and second of all, I've been an activist as a university professor.
Nuestro trabajo en Bolivia es sobre una coalición llamada Coordinadora de Defensa del Agua y la Vida.
Our work in Bolivia is through a coalition called the Coordinator, or the Coalition for the Defense of Water and Life.
Nuestro trabajo fundamental ha sido el de orientar a la población sobre lo que iba a suceder con un contrato firmado por una empresa, precisamente una transnacional que tiene su sede acá en San Francisco.
Our main line of work has been raising levels of awareness about the privatization contract that was signed in Bolivia between the government of Bolivia and a transnational corporation based here in the Bay Area.
Esta empresa, Bechtel, a través de un consorcio formado, intentó privatizar el agua en Cochabamba, el servicio de agua potable en Cochabamba.
This company, the Bechtel Corporation, through the creation of a consortium, sought to privatize and control the water system of Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Los ambientalistas, profesionales, campesinos y otros sectores agrupados en esta coalición, nos percatamos de que esta privatización era atentatorio a la población.
And it was clear from the perspective of many people, the environmentalists, the peasants, workers and other professionals, that this contract was going to be harmful to our interests.
Por esta razón es que durante más de 7 meses advertimos a la población hasta que finalmente la población confirmó que esta empresa iba a simplemente a lucrar allá y no a invertir dinero.
And through a long process, 7 months of work, of consciousness raising about what this contract would mean, people came to understand that it was going to be damaging and that they were going to be basically pumping money out of the community without investing.
Entonces, el gobierno intentó proteger este contrato, un contrato mal ejecutado, un contrato mal llevado, intentó proteger por todas las vías para lo que emitió una ley.
The government did everything in its power to see the Bolivian government to push this contract through. A bad contract, a contract that was going to be damaging to us. And one of the key things that they did was to approve a law.
Esta ley no solamente afectaba a la población local, sino afectaba a todo el país porque también incluía un proceso de privatización en todo Bolivia.
This law not only affected people locally in Cochabamba, but the entire country because it created a framework within which water could and had to be privatized throughout the entire country.
Esto originó un descontento de toda la población en Cochabamba que en abril del año pasado culminó con una especie de insurrección en contra de este contrato y de la ley.
So these two things together, the law and the contract, really galvanized opposition on the part of people. And in April of last year, we had basically an insurrectionary situation where people rose up to demand cancellation of the contract and changes in the law.
En abril, durante 7 días, la población protestó en las calles, peleó contra la policía, ganó a la policía y ganó al ejército.
During 7 days in April of last year, people fought against the police and against the army and won the battle.
Durante ese tiempo, la gente participaron niños, ancianos, mujeres, y fue toda la población la que salió a las calles a pelear.
Participation was massive. It wasn't just a few people. It was also men, women, young people, old people, everyone in the streets fighting together until they finally won.
Al cabo de estas jornadas, se culminó echando a esta empresa transnacional en la cual participaba Bechtel.
And at the end of the day, the company had been forced out. The contract had been canceled. Bechtel had basically been forced out of Bolivia.
Asimismo, se modificó la ley que había planteado la privatización del agua para todo el país.
At the same time, we were able to force changes in the legislation that called for privatization of water throughout the whole country.
Debemos señalar que todo este conjunto de políticas de privatización no han sido solamente por acción del gobierno o de una empresa, sino también son las políticas recomendadas por el Banco Mundial, básicamente por el BID, que recomiendan y además les ponen como condición a nuestros gobiernos la privatización del agua en nuestros países.
I should mention that this idea to privatize water was not just the idea of a company or the government of Bolivia. These are also policies that are undertaken under strong recommendations by the World Bank and the other international financial institutions, which are pushing hard for water privatization.
Pero además debemos señalar que en el caso específico de Cochabamba, el Banco Mundial emitió un documento con toda claridad señalando que en Cochabamba debería privatizarse el agua.
And especially in the case of Cochabamba, it's clear that from internal World Bank documents, we know that the World Bank was explicitly calling for privatization of the water system in Cochabamba.
No entendemos nosotros cómo estas organizaciones, estos organismos de desarrollo, teniendo políticas de lucha contra la pobreza, intentan privatizar estos recursos básicos.
And we don't understand, we've never been able to understand how these international so-called development agencies that claim to be fighting poverty could in turn call for the privatization of water.
Nosotros creemos que lo que ha sucedido en Cochabamba después de 15 años de neoliberalismo, después de que los bolivianos no podíamos hablar cuando la población salió a las calles a defender sus derechos, creemos nosotros que hemos aportado un tanto para la lucha del país, para la lucha de los pueblos de América.
And we feel now that after 15 years of the application of these neoliberal policies by the World Bank and the other international financial institutions, we in Cochabamba, by beginning to exercise our voice, to take to the streets, to roll back this privatization, we've won things for Bolivia, but we've also contributed to a larger movement at the global level to reverse these policies.
Esta lucha todavía no ha concluido. Todavía existen en este momento algunas reivindicaciones que faltan por consolidar. Falta todavía una reglamentación. El gobierno está intentando revertir todavía este proceso.
But the struggle isn't over. We still have a lot of work ahead of us. For example, the laws, the legal changes, the legislative changes that we were able to effect are not consolidated, and the government is striking back and trying to erode those. And we're right now struggling over the regulations that go along with the legislative changes that we want.
También debemos señalar que en este momento la coalición se ha hecho cargo de la gestión del servicio de agua potable en Cochabamba. Y lo ha hecho positivamente y en este momento se han tenido resultados halagadores.
I should also mention that the coalition that I'm a member of has taken over effectively running the local water system and with positive results so far.
Esta gestión se la está llevando adelante con una amplia participación social, además desde el punto de vista de la gestión local.
And we're doing this with very high levels of participation of the local peoples. And that is to say, we're running the company now locally.
Todavía estas iniciativas están siendo bloqueadas tanto por el gobierno como por los organismos internacionales al no permitir el acceso a algún crédito para fortalecer la empresa.
But both the government and the international financial institutions are blocking these initiatives, trying to put a stop to it through various mechanisms. Already mentioned that the government is trying to manipulate changes in the laws that were won in April, and also by prohibiting access of the local water company to credit, that is to say, by not recognizing it as credit worthy, and thus trying to frustrate investment plans on the part of the local water operator, now controlled by the people.
En Cochabamba, debemos señalar como antecedente que estos procesos de privatización no van más. Nosotros creemos que el pueblo cochabambino no va a permitir más adelante ningún proceso de privatización y creemos que ha sido un hito importante.
Finally, in conclusion, I'd just like to say that we feel that these privatization programs have reached their limit. It's been demonstrated they don't work for us, and the people of Cochabamba have been unequivocal. They've said very clearly that they won't take these privatization programs anymore. That would be it.
Why do you think the World Bank was targeting Cochabamba in particular?
Básicamente porque, para las recomendaciones del Banco Mundial para toda América Latina han sido de la de privatización de todos los servicios básicos.
First of all, it's not that Cochabamba is all that special. The World Bank has, across the board in Latin America, been pushing the privatization of basic services generally.
Y el control del Banco Mundial sobre nuestros gobiernos es bastante fuerte.
And the control the World Bank exercises over our governments is very strong.
Ni bien los gobiernos intentan solicitar algún crédito, el Banco Mundial condiciona estos créditos.
As soon as the government asks for a line of credit or access to credit, immediately the World Bank steps in with all sorts of conditions.
Y en el caso de Cochabamba, esto estaba sujeto a un proyecto que precisamente fortalecía el sistema de red y de distribución de agua potable.
And in the Cochabamba case, it was conditions that accompanied various investment projects that were aimed at providing more water and broadening the distribution network.
Entonces, cuando algún organismo intentó solicitar que se le diera crédito para este proyecto a Cochabamba, el Banco Mundial inmediatamente rechazó esto y planteó que debería privatizarse el agua.
So when initiatives arose for financing and for these projects in Cochabamba, the World Bank stepped in and, using their conditionality, insisted that one of the conditions would be the privatization of the local water system.
Can you please describe some of the hardships that the people endured when the water rates went up?
Básicamente, se ha tenido una fuerte represión por parte de la policía, el ejército. Han habido más de 300 heridos de bala.
First of all, there was intense repression at the hands of the police and the military. Over 300 people were wounded, many of them by live ammunition fired by the army.
En todo Bolivia, en Cochabamba ha habido un muerto y en el resto del país han existido otros 7 muertos.
In Cochabamba, one person was killed, and through the rest of the country, another 7 people were killed.
Entonces, en esto no solamente fue en abril, sino también hubieron otros muertos en el mes de septiembre, que todavía es un proceso por las reivindicaciones en el agua.
But this process continues. The demands for seeing the water issue adequately resolved is a struggle that continues. After April and September, there was another round of protests and repression, and it's a struggle that continues today.
Existieron cientos de detenidos, se reprimió duramente a la población en las calles, o sea, se militarizó la ciudad, pero finalmente se logró derrotar al ejército y a la policía.
In April, there were hundreds of people who were detained. Martial law was declared during a 3-month period. The cities were militarized. But in spite of all this, we won.
Are there still any political prisoners being held in jail as a result of this struggle?
No hay, pero todavía el gobierno ejerce presión sobre la gente. O sea, no hay presos políticos, pero ejerce una fuerte presión sobre los diferentes dirigentes.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but the answer is no. At this point, there are no political prisoners, but he's clear in stating that the government still is exercising a great deal of pressure over the leaders and activists in the movement. And I'm going to elaborate here, William, and other cosa. There have been consistent death threats, phone tappings, people being followed, meetings being infiltrated, etc. So the pressure is still on very high.
What I'd like to know is, what do you think is the key, or was the key, to the people's victory last year?
Lo que en realidad unió a todos los cochabambinos fue el grado de injusticia al que se había estado se pretendió obligar.
What brought people together was the extreme injustice that everyone across these different sectors of society had been dealt.
Un gobierno que no quiso escuchar la injusticia que se señaló abiertamente respecto a un contrato y también respecto a una ley.
A government that was completely deaf before people's complaints about a law that they didn't agree with and a contract that hit them hard.
En numerosas oportunidades, profesionales, diferentes sectores de la población habían demostrado que este contrato era un contrato de lo más absurdo porque señalaba que esta empresa no llevaba un solo centavo a invertir allí a Cochabamba y pretendía además que llevarse dinero de Cochabamba.
Different professional associations and independent analysts had demonstrated that this contract was absolutely absurd and unconscionable because without putting any money into the community it was going to pump millions out through water charges.
Lo mismo con un marco global para este contrato se emitió una ley que entre líneas planteaba la privatización del agua en todo el país.
Also, there was enabling legislation for this water privatization process that, if you read the law, you would see basically was calling for privatization of all sources of water and the handling of water throughout the country.
Eso es lo que unió a todo el pueblo cochabambino, pero también detrás de todo esto está la injusticia que permanentemente sufre por parte y la que normalmente infieren los políticos. La corrupción, la injusticia es lo que ha llevado a que se una al pueblo cochabambino.
What brought people together was anger at the injustice of these things, which is a common experience in Bolivia, given the desperate situation, the desperate poverty of many people, compounded by the corruption of politicians.
Esto ha hecho que el pueblo cochabambino no pueda soportar más este tipo de injusticias y salga a las calles a protestar masivamente.
Simply put, people hit their limits, and we're going to take this anymore, and that's what got people together out in the streets protesting.
What do you think will happen to Bolivia, to Cochabamba, if the ALCA actually
is put into effect.
¿Qué significará el ALCA para Cochabamba, para Bolivia?
Generar más procesos de privatización. Eso es lo que nosotros vemos de este proceso, que entre comillas es un proceso de integración, pero más que ello va a abrir lo que ya tenemos, o sea, va a desregular más la economía de lo que ya está. Hoy día en Bolivia está totalmente privatizado y bueno, seguirán con las empresas intentando este proceso de privatización.
Well, the free trade, the FTAA claims that it's for international integration, but what we've seen is that it's more about privatization and about a select few making a lot of money. Everything in Bolivia that can be privatized basically has been privatized. So we see this trade agreement as just more of the same, and we see that we're not winners in these agreements.
Quisiéramos que cuando se desregulen los mercados también se desregulen los de los países desarrollados para que nosotros podamos exportar nuestros productos.
Another piece of this that we'd like to mention is that if there is going to be deregulation, how about deregulating the markets in the north so that we can begin to export some of our products to the north?
Pero se ponen una serie de barreras arancelarias que no nos permiten ni siquiera llegar a la frontera de nuestros países.
So there is no free trade today. The same people who propose free trade aren't practicers of free trade. It's very hard to get our products to the United States.
And just one more thing, and that is, if what is the message of your organization to activists in the United States and Canada?
Básicamente queremos señalar que lo que hemos hecho en Cochabamba es simplemente el inicio, y creemos que es el inicio de luchar contra un modelo que está afectando no solamente en Bolivia, sino le afecta a todo el mundo.
First of all, we want to say that what we've started in Cochabamba is just the beginning, and that together we're going to have to continue to struggle against an unjust economic system that perpetuates these injustices not just in Bolivia, but all over the world, and it's the same struggle.
Lo importante es que ya no es un mundo silencioso, sino más bien la gente quiere, además, que se le escuche. Eso es lo que nosotros hemos entendido de todo lo que ha ocurrido en Cochabamba, de todo lo que ha sucedido, y creemos que lo que está sucediendo en Sitle o que está sucediendo en Quebec están en esa misma vía.
But the good thing is that people are no longer quiescent. It's no longer a quiet world. People are beginning to speak up. We think that this is one of the most important things of our struggle in Cochabamba, that people have recovered their ability to speak out and what they're in favor of. We think that's the big lesson from Seattle, one of the lessons from Quebec too.
Por lo tanto, creemos que algún momento vamos a triunfar, y ese es el mensaje que nosotros podemos llevarles, y además es un mensaje de que estos movimientos deben ser solidarios entre ellos.
So the message that we would send to activists in the United States and Canada is that we can have victories, we will have victories. It is a common struggle, and we'll have to work together.
Bechtel is suing the government of Bolivia for loss of the Cochabamba water system. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris for the Independent Media Center of San Francisco.
Father Roy Bourgeois of School of the Americas Watch describes himself as having been a young man who didn't question our leaders. He joined the army and volunteered to fight in Vietnam. What he saw there made him question the necessity of violence and re-examine his spirituality. He left the army and joined the Mary Knoll Order to do missionary work with the poor. He spoke with Neil Golder in Ithaca last month about the evolution of the movement to close the U.S. Army's School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. It was his assignment as a missionary to a poor Bolivian community that further radicalized him, he said, and set him on his path.
It was in this slum of Bolivia, where I lived for 5 years with the poor, that really changed me in many big ways. It was there that the poor who I went to serve, they became my teachers. I saw firsthand the brutality of the military toward the poor. Mm-hmm. It was under a brutal dictatorship, General Hugo Banzer, when I was there, who had come into power through a violent coup. I mean, this guy was a bully. They were thugs. They were running the country. They were there, the military, the men with the guns, as they do throughout Latin America and the developing world. They are there, the men with the guns, the militaries, to defend, really, to sustain that socioeconomic system mm-hmm. that keeps the rich rich and the poor poor. Mm-hmm. And when we began to speak out, I was very happy in Bolivia, you know, but it saddened me to see my country supporting this dictatorship, giving guns and training to those soldiers who were at war with the poor. And we began to organize. The repression intensified as we went about our daily lives of working for a clinic, a daycare center, a literacy program. And I just felt I belonged there. I felt so at home in Bolivia, feeling this is where I want to be. But then in my fifth year, as the repression intensified, we formed a human rights commission made up of labor leaders, university leaders, healthcare workers, church leaders, and we began to speak out against the repression. And I was among many who were arrested and was forced out of Bolivia. And when I came back, I joined many people really working on El Salvador, which began sort of a new chapter in my life, but really the same struggle. It was about Latin America, the same struggle there. Struggle of the poor simply to survive, simply to try and make it through each day. And what we found in El Salvador was really a microcosm of Latin America. The vast majority of the people living in abject poverty, dying before their time. A small elite there, the so-called 14 families in El Salvador, who own most of the land, the wealth, the power. And what we saw there also was our country giving guns to those soldiers doing the killing. And it was that year, 1980, that Archbishop Oscar Romero was killed for his defense of the poor. Months later, four U.S. churchwomen were raped and killed. What we learned, though, that those guns who went to those soldiers came from our country. And what we did know also was that 525 Salvadoran soldiers arrived at Fort Benning, Georgia, to start training. It was then that I canceled a whole lot of talks at colleges and churches around the country, and I went to Georgia to protest the arrival of these Salvadoran soldiers to be trained in combat at Fort Benning with our tax money, knowing that was going to be that was going
this
to
be in the midst of all the repression that was happening in El Salvador. Yeah.
So we did an action, three of us, Linda, who was in the Army Reserves, Larry Rosebaum, an oblate priest, and I. We dressed as high-ranking Army officers, went on to Fort Benning at night, carrying with us a boombox that contained in Spanish the last sermon of Archbishop Oscar Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was killed, when he made a special appeal to the men in the military to stop the killing, to lay down their arms. And we took his words, the words of this prophet, this martyr, Oscar Romero, penetrated this high security area as high-ranking officers, and we got saluted. We were scared, went near the barracks where the Salvadorans were housed, and with tree climbers, we climbed this tall pine tree, and we waited. And around 10 o'clock, when the lights went out in the barracks, we just said, "Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother." And his voice just boomed into the barracks. And I can only say that they were very upset with us, very angry. We had upset their training big time. They came out with their guns, their M16s, their dogs. They arrested us, told us to get down or they would shoot us down. We left the boom box up there, however, blasting away. They handcuffed us, kicked us around, brought us to the county jail, then to trial. Then we were sentenced to prison for 18 months. And I can only say that prison, we learned early on that they could send us to prison, Neil, but they couldn't silence us. The truth cannot be silenced. It was when we got out of this, you know, prison after serving the 18 months in good shape, we joined thousands of people still trying to stop the military at El Salvador, but we couldn't do it. Another massacre, November the 16th, 1989, there at this Jesuit college, university there in El Salvador, run by the Catholic Order of Priests, the Jesuits. After midnight, six of these Jesuits, who were professors, well-known scholars there, a young mother and her 15-year-old daughter, they're dragged out of their rooms there on the campus, and they are massacred. And this made, of course, front pages of newspapers all over the world, got the attention of many in Congress. We were pumping into El Salvador at that time $1 million a day. So they send a congressional task force headed by Representative Joseph Moakley from Massachusetts. They go to investigate and come back reporting that those responsible were trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. Mm-hmm. It was then, Neil, that the School of the Americas was coming into the papers. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, those instincts just set in. You know, you know that it's very important to go down to Georgia, to Fort Benning, and to investigate the School of the Americas, really that we knew practically nothing about. And we opened up an office right outside of the main gate of Fort Benning. We called it the SOA Watch, School of the Americas Watch. And we went to work, I and friends who came down. We started gathering from the Freedom of Information Act and from human rights reports a very, very important history of this school. And what we learned is that this school was well known in Latin America. It trained over 60,000 soldiers, trained dictators, death squad leaders. This school was a school of assassins, a school of terror, well known, again, in throughout Latin America, especially in El Salvador and Guatemala, in Chile, in Honduras, in Bolivia, in Colombia. We would have most of the soldiers coming in from Colombia today. Now, here in our country, it was unknown, hiding behind this wall of secrecy. And all we did, really, was to take our research. And what we were discovering, Neil, was that there were hundreds of these soldiers that we documented, and there were many more because the U.S. embassies in these countries, along with the State Department and the U.S. Army, had thousands of documents that they would not share with us. It would lead to even more documentation of these graduates. But we had documented hundreds, 600 plus of these soldiers who had killed, who had tortured, who had raped, who had committed crimes against humanity. We learned that those graduates of this school were responsible for the assassination of Bishop Romero, who raped and killed the church women, who massacred the 6 Jesuit priests and the young mother and her daughter, who participated in El Masote, where over 800 were killed, including over 100 children, and many, many other crimes. And all we did was take this information, the documenting these graduates and their crimes against humanity. We took it into colleges, church groups, faith communities, peace groups, and it was then that a movement took root. A movement was born, and we started with a small group 11 years ago, really with a group of 10. Every spring we would go to Washington to lobby, to call on our members of Congress to shut down this school, to take the $20 million that they're using from our tax money to train these soldiers in combat skills like commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency, and to shut down that school and take that money and use that for schools for our children. And that was every spring in Washington to lobby. Every November, we head to Georgia. We would gather at the main gate of Fort Benning to say, not in our name will this continue. We gather thousands there. We would gather to keep alive the memory of those who were killed, to speak for them, those who had been silenced. Now, last year, we had 10,000 who gathered there from all over the country, many from our community here. And it's become a tradition in the movement to cross the line, to go on to Fort Benning, and to participate in what's called a solemn funeral procession. We carry coffins, we carry these symbols with the names of the victims, and their names are called, and after their names, everyone would say presente. They are present here with us today. And they arrested this past November, 3,500 crossed the line, and 1,700 were processed. 26 of that group just received their letters to go to trial in Columbus, Georgia. They have been indicted for going across the line for trespassing, and they will have to go to trial May the 22nd. In the group of 26 are college students, their parents with children still in high school. We have 3 nuns in the group, one 89 years old, Sister Dorothy from Dubuque, Iowa. We have Jack Gilroy from our local community here, who's among the 26, who will be going to prison and in a real way representing the many from this area of the country who every year go to Georgia, who have been working for years on this issue. So I can only say, Neil, that the movement is really growing. This upcoming trial, Jack Gilroy's going to prison along with the others, along with the group working so hard here in this area, that the movement will continue to grow. We are not going away. We're going to keep gathering at the main gate of Fort Benning.
Roy, as you know, the name of the School of Americas has been changed, and the U.S. military has claimed that the syllabus has been changed and modified, and there's been reform of this school, to and that they're being taught how to teach democracy. Do you think that's happening from what you know, or what is?
No, let me say, Neil, that here's what's happened. This is the reality of things. The movement got so big, they put so much pressure on the Pentagon, they had to do something. So what they did, they said, let's change the name of the school with the hope that the movement was simply going to disappear, go away, that we'd be fooled or something, that this was really closing down the school. It's really a name change. It's an SOA clone. It's a new name, but the same shame. Now, it's like taking a bottle of poison and calling it penicillin. It's still deadly. Mm-hmm. And I can only say that we are not going away. No one has been fooled by this. We're going to keep gathering at Fort Benning, Georgia every year in greater numbers. They say to us that they've made some changes, that they're now teaching democracy at the school. And we look at the curriculum and we ask a basic question. You know, how do you teach democracy through the barrel of a gun? Most of the courses at the school are still about combat. They're still about commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency techniques. Who are the insurgents? They are who they've always been. They're the poor. And those who work with the poor, university leaders, journalists, they're human rights advocates, they're healthcare workers, labor leaders. They have become really the targets who have, the soldiers who have trained at this school. And so we ask, how do you teach democracy through the barrel of a gun? We also say, how do you teach democracy at an undemocratic institution? How do you teach democracy at Fort Benning, Georgia? We say, shut it down. Mm-hmm. There's so much suffering and death connected to this school. It cannot be transformed. Mm-hmm. It can only be closed. And that is the message. Mm-hmm. Let me say this, that there's a bill pending in Congress. It's called the Moakley-McGovern Bill. Representatives Moakley and McGovern are sponsoring another bill. Last year we lost by 10 votes. It was 214 to 204 to change the name of the school. Letters to members of Congress, representatives and senators, that they cut off the funding in the school. This is something mm-hmm. everyone can do. Mm-hmm. Bishop Romero said it really well. He said, we can all do something and do it well. And one mm-hmm. thing that we can do is to write those letters to our representatives sure. and our senators with a simple request, shut down the School of Assassins. One other thing that's very important, we've got an excellent video that gives us more information about the school that we can get hold of and spread the word. Mm-hmm. This is how the movement grows. Mm-hmm. We get information and we spread the word. The video title is SOA Guns and Greed. It connects the School of the Americas to the sweatshops, to the global giants, the new conquistadors, mm-hmm. the multinational corporations who are exploiting the cheap labor and the vast resources there. This video, an excellent resource, SOA Guns and Greed, can be ordered by simply calling 1-800-227-8523. 800-227-8523. And of course, there's our important website to really get a lot more information, and that's www.soaw.org. That's SOAW.org. There's all kinds of information we can get from the website about the upcoming trial of Jack Gilroy and the other 25, about what's going to be happening in November, and many other things that are going on in the movement.
You mentioned that the school is paid for by U.S. taxes, and there's an ongoing war tax resistance movement. Do you see that as another tactic for people withhold their taxes or part of their taxes?
Very important. Oh, yes, yes, mm-hmm. yes, yes. Extremely important. Mm-hmm. That it's really, I mean, what better way to say it to our government, to the Pentagon, that, you know, I'm not going to participate in your war making. I'm not going to give you my money for war to support this school. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is the most practical way, individually and as groups, as a community, that we can participate in peacemaking. I mean, what more powerful statement mm-hmm. to make, that I'm not going to give you money for your death machines, for your SOA schools, you know? Yeah. And so I think the message, too, comes from us, from Archbishop Oscar Romero, who said before, just shortly before he was assassinated, he said, let those who have a voice speak for the voiceless. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is really what we're invited to do, is to see, really, and so many in the community here have been doing that. They've been mm-hmm. speaking for the voiceless, for the powerless, they've been organizing, working for peace for a long time on many different issues. And that's what we have to keep doing, speaking, organizing, marching. And, of course, we've got to root what we do, we believe, in nonviolence.
I think also we need to understand what's behind the news that we hear. For instance, mm-hmm. We hear about the war on drugs and Plan Colombia and things mm-hmm. like this, where an ordinary person might think, yes, this is a good idea, we have to stop the flow of drugs and the U.S. can help do that.
You know, this Plan Colombia, extremely important. I mean, very, very serious stuff here. We are pumping into Colombia $1.3 billion to fight the so-called drug war, to stop the cocaine from coming from Colombia to our country, where the big demand, of course, is here. I was part of a delegation that went to Colombia to look into Plan Colombia. We talked with the military there, the high-ranking military officers. They, of course, are overjoyed with this Plan Colombia. It's enriching them. It's giving them more power. It's lining their pockets. It's lining the pockets of people like, Monsanto Corporation, who's producing this strong chemical glyphosate that they are spraying on the coca plants. It's enriching, of course, bringing millions and millions into the stockholders' pockets from Sikorsky, who turn out the Black Hawk helicopters in Connecticut. The large corporations, they benefit from war. They are making huge profits from Plan Colombia. But let me say this. We went to Putumayo, where we met with the indigenous leaders, the campesinos, the landless farmers, and we talked with them about Plan Colombia. And what we found there really was the truth of Plan Colombia. They showed us how this strong chemical being sprayed on the coca plants, out of which, again, it makes the raw material for the cocaine, how they're killing not only the coca plants, but the yucca trees, their banana plants. It's killing their rice, their beans. It's destroying their food sources. It's polluting their rivers. It's causing a lot of problems. It's causing a lot of problems for their children, health problems, respiratory problems, skin rashes. And what they said to us was very, very clear, that Plan Colombia is a plan of death. Plan Colombia, really, it's killing Mother Earth, and it's also killing them. And they asked, before we left the country, I must say, they appealed to us to come back to our own country and to simply try and spread the word as much as we can, that Plan Colombia is really a plan of death. This year, we're going to hear a lot about Plan Colombia, of course, the $1.3 billion. That's the first installment. They're going to want more and more and more. And what we'll have to, we have to do is really start organizing. Talk about, there are a lot of folks talking about a boycott of Monsanto that's producing the glyphosate, the strong chemical. The same corporation that brought us Agent Orange in Vietnam, responsible for the death of so many there.
Some people have said to me, so you close the School of the Americas, you know, what then? There's probably similar schools all over the place training soldiers. How do you
Sure, we'll close them one at a time, but let me say, this school is not your average school, your ordinary school. This school is the West Point of Latin America. This school is very prestigious. It began way back in 1946, trained over 60,000 soldiers in combat. This school has played a vital part in U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. That's why today the Pentagon is fighting hard to keep this school going. It's very important, this school. It's their way of controlling Latin America's people. You control their military, you control, really, their people. You also provide the muscle, and this is really the key issue here, Neil. You provide the muscle for the sweatshops, for those economic giants, for the IMF and the World Bank, for the new conquistadors, the multinational corporations who come into Latin America to enrich themselves as the old conquistadors from the 16th century. They are there to exploit the cheap labor and the vast resources there to really, again, to exploit, to enrich themselves. And what they are doing simply cannot be done without the men with the guns. Mm-hmm. And 60,000 have been trained soldiers. The men with the guns have gone through this school, and they continue to turn out about 2,000 every year. We shut down this school. We have a big fiesta. Uh-huh. We remind ourselves what can happen if we really come together by the thousands and work together. And we keep moving ahead. Let me just say, Neil, it's all connected. We're not, you know, in competition with each other. It's all a process. Mm. It's a lifelong struggle. And we realize, we learn, of course, this from so many sisters and brothers in Latin America, I mean, in the developing world, who have been struggling for centuries, trying to get some justice in their lives, trying to get out of this oppression, this exploitation, this dominance that the United States would have over them in our corporations and our World Bank, you know, and all of the other economic giants. But what we're learning is that how we all need each other. As I look around, I see so many groups working on so many issues, coming together really with a common goal, a common agenda.
I've noticed U.S. Union people becoming involved in this campaign,
exactly,
too.
Exactly.
So that there is an awareness that it has an effect, you know, I mean, obviously it has an effect, but it has a very direct effect on jobs. And
the human rights people, union labor leaders, you know, I mean, like in Latin America, I mean, it's the labor leaders who are really being prosecuted, who are being killed, kidnapped, picked up, your healthcare workers, you know, your environmentalists. I mean, again, we're all becoming very, very connected. And I think this really is the hope of this struggle. When we start coming together, working together, you know, in a sense as one, this is where the power is. And this, I think, will continue to happen. As I travel around, I just see a lot of hope. I see, it gives me great joy to see this happening. And it will continue to happen. And the message, of course, is we can all do something and do it well. What one person's doing, it's not better than another. You know, some of us perhaps have more time, more energy, but we can all do something and do it well. And I would just like to extend an invitation again to our listeners to just, let's just, you know, ask, you know, what can we do to bring some more justice, some more peace, some more hope into our world.
That was Father Roy Bourgeois of School of the Americas Watch speaking with Neil Golder in Ithaca last month. Victoria Talley-Corpuz is director of the Tebtebe Foundation, the Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education. She spoke last month at the Indigenous Peoples Forum on Cultural Rights at the University of Hawaii that was held in conjunction with protests against the meeting of the Asian Development Bank, a part of the IMF and World Bank complex.
As we all know, basically globalization now, as we see it, is really a war over resources, no? The last remaining resources in the world, and also it's a war over mindsets or development frameworks, if you might call it, no? And for indigenous peoples who have lived very sustainably, the consumption is more sustainable. We don't really waste a lot of the resources that we have. And we have fought because we have resisted against colonization since Spanish colonization up to the present. The world's remaining resources are really left in our communities. You know, whether these are mineral resources or oil or biodiversity forests. And therefore, these communities have become the targets of these multinational corporations who would like to come and exploit all these resources for their own interests. And unfortunately, many of the governments in whom we find ourselves in are also colluding with these corporations to get hold of these resources. So therefore, we can see that many of the armed conflicts that are happening all over the world now are really taking place in indigenous people's communities. And if you remember when the Zapatistas rose up in Mexico in 1994 against NAFTA, the people who were really rising up were the indigenous peoples of Chiapas. You know, these really were the people who were protesting against the move of NAFTA, of the Mexican government, to remove the law that allows them to continue holding on to their communal lands. And last December, we had a conference on conflict resolution in indigenous peoples. It was an international conference. We were able to bring indigenous peoples from as far as Colombia, you know, the Uwa peoples, to Rwanda, the Pygmies in Rwanda, and even as far as Sierra Leone, and of course our own indigenous peoples from Asia. We had people from Indonesia, from Aceh, from West Papua, you know, and also other parts, even from the Solomon Islands. And when we came together, we really saw that the main cause of all the conflicts that are taking place in our lands are because of the conflicts over land and resources. And unfortunately, we also looked at some of the peace, agreements that were negotiated. We also had Maya peoples from Guatemala, and we looked into all these peace agreements that were negotiated, like the Peace Accord of Guatemala, the San Andres Accords in Mexico, you know, and the Chittagong Hill Tracts Accord, Peace Accord in Bangladesh. And in most of these peace accords, they haven't really addressed to the satisfaction of indigenous peoples the issue that they have been raising. And so we feel that there was really some gap that needs to be filled up in relation to how these accords are being negotiated, and more especially how they are also being implemented. And in this meeting and in the various meetings that indigenous peoples have, we have seen how the resistance of indigenous peoples have really contributed significantly to this fight against globalization. We have seen how, for instance, the resistance against biopiracy has been so strong, and these are the contribution of indigenous peoples here has been strong, precisely because, mainly because the resources, you know, like the medicinal plants or the traditional plants that are being patented by these multinational pharmaceutical drugs or biotechnology companies, drug companies, are really coming from indigenous people's communities. And the ones who have challenged them, like the ayahuasca drug of the plant in Latin America, which is a traditional and sacred plant used by the indigenous peoples in Ecuador, you know, and this was patented by the United States. They challenged this, and there was a campaign that was really sustained over this, and therefore they were able to get off get the patent holders to withdraw their patent applications over the drug. And this does the same case with quinoa. This is another food crop that the indigenous peoples in South America also have been using. They also challenge these patents. So that's in relation to biodiversity. In relation to lands, of course, we have the struggles against the mines, as I mentioned yesterday, where successfully some communities were able to kick out many of these powerful mining corporations, particularly, say, in the Philippines. In Latin America, there were also mining companies which were kicked out. And recently, we have read in the news about the peoples in Aceh, you know, the Aceh in Indonesia, they are fighting against oil, the oil drilling of ExxonMobil. And ExxonMobil has the biggest production of natural gas from that particular place. I think they pump out some, they exploit something like 1.6 billion tons of natural gas. ExxonMobil was forced to get out. They declared in March 10 that they are not going to continue their drilling anymore because of the conflict that's taking place there, you know. And so these are just a few of the struggles that indigenous peoples have fought to maintain their control over their lands. And of course, we know about the dam struggles which have been taking place since time immemorial, you know, since we were colonized up to now. And the World Commission on Dams has come up with a huge report affirming that indeed these hydroelectric dams are very unsustainable. These mega hydroelectric dams are very unsustainable. They have not really served the objectives that they were set to achieve, and therefore they are recommending that these kinds of projects should not continue, and that a rights-based approach and a risk assessment approach should be the approach that should be taken by governments, by multilateral bodies, before they engage in these kinds of projects. So virtually, they are really saying that there should be a moratorium already on the building of big hydroelectric dams, as these are very unsustainable projects. Then we have, of course, indigenous peoples who have been actively fighting in the realm of the climate change, you know, the global warming issue, because, as you might know, the president of the United States, Bush, had said that he would like the United States to keep away from the Kyoto Protocol. And this is most unfortunate because the United States of America, which has only 4% population of the world, emits 25% of the global greenhouse gas emissions, you know, and therefore they're really the main cause of these greenhouse gas emissions, and yet the government has chosen not to take part in fulfilling the obligations that they signed, that they agreed to, you know. And now what they are trying to say is that instead of them participating here, maybe they will just support what they call this, clean development mechanism, where they are pushing developing countries to, they are going to give them money to put up tree plantations which will absorb the carbon that is being emitted from this part of the world. You know, they call it the carbon sinks. And now they have something called the emissions trading. You know, they are now again using the market-based, you know, tools, emission trading, where they will trade emissions with those who are not producing enough gas, and they will, they will have this emissions trading, and then they have people now who are called the emissions brokers, you know, who will make the deals with, like, the United States is emitting this much of carbon dioxide. Then they will make a deal with Russia, who has not met their level, so they will trade, and they will have to pay Russia some amount of money. You know, that's the kind of proposal that's coming up in the climate change negotiations, and indigenous peoples have protested these kinds of proposals, mainly because if they are pushing for tree plantations, that means that we are going to lose again our forests, and tree plantations will come into the picture again. And also this process of using only market tools to address the issue of unsustainability of environmental destruction is really something that goes against our own values and the way that we have been living as peoples. So those are just the kinds of resistance. And in terms of how do we strengthen these kinds of moves that the indigenous peoples are doing? And then finally, we are, I think, two more points. In terms of policy advocacy, I think we really need to influence the way in which the laws in our own countries are being developed, you know, either to resist the changes that are being made to conform to the WTO agreements or to the IMF, World Bank, and ADB prescriptions, to call that this should not be come into our, you know, resist all these kinds of changes, but at the same time to call for policies and laws that will really support what they popularly call a sustainable development. All governments in the world now are singing praises to sustainable development, but we really don't know what they mean, you know. So we want them to really make it more concrete. If they say that they will support sustainable agriculture, then they, by all means, they should put more money in supporting the sustainable agricultural practices that we would like to have, you know, like the organic agriculture, this, you know, not using all these expensive pesticides, etc., and to change the laws that promote those kinds of agriculture. In energy, for instance, they are talking about renewable energy should be really strengthened because this is going to lessen the emissions for the globe that causes global warming. But they are not really supporting it. All the oil, you know, and oil drilling, coal mining, uranium mining, and now, in fact, the nuclear energy industry is really coming up very strongly because they are now claiming that they are the clean energy and they will not emit all these bad emissions that the oil industry is emitting, you know. And we have to fight against that because some governments are really pushing for it. And also to call for the governments to support the renewable energy programs that are really very appropriate for many indigenous peoples. In fact, we had a caucus recently on energy, and some indigenous peoples have presented small energy projects which are very renewable, which are enough to light their own communities and for their own purposes. And it really is something that they can manage and control. And I think this is the kind of thing that we need to do to really undermine the power of these huge energy corporations that are just coming to our countries and taking over our energy sector. And the last point is, of course, to help build these sustainable models, you know, that are really there in indigenous peoples' communities. Walden said that, you know, another world is possible. I will say that other worlds are already existing there, which are more sustainable, which are really more appropriate for peoples who don't want to live, you know, in the way that these unsustainable lifestyles are. And we have to just simply support this and call on our governments not to destroy these communities, because these are really the communities that we would like to develop further and become and really expand more widely, because this is what is going to be the alternative to what we are seeing now. And we really hope that these kinds of struggles that indigenous peoples are waging and the models that they are building will be supported, because the conflicts and the conflicts that are going to that are happening now will really become even more if we don't become more active in terms of giving solidarity, in terms of supporting, in terms of denouncing all these corporations and the governments, the industrialized governments, which are causing these problems for us. Thank you very much.
That was Victoria Tully Corpus, director of the Tebteba Foundation, speaking last month in Honolulu. Protests have been called for this fall in Washington, D.C., when the IMF will be meeting. For more info, see www.infoshop.org. That's infoshop.org. Thanks to Sue Supriano for that tape.